This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava, and Election Day looms just a week and a half away. The presidential candidates and candidates for state office are ramping up their rhetoric. Yet, as they try to sway voters on who to vote for, there's another question out there of how to vote here in North Carolina. We welcome your calls this hour. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. And we begin our reporters' roundtable today with Charlotte Observer political reporter Jack Betts. Thanks for coming back, Jack.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I'd like to start out with this one issue about the ballots. I think there might be some confusion. At the top of the North Carolina ballot, there is a box where you can check Democrat, Republican, or Libertarian, and vote straight party ticket. And that leads you to think that if you check, say, Republican, you have voted for every Republican on the ballot, including the president. But in effect, you haven't.
That's right. In fact, for going on 40 years now, you haven't. And the question arises almost every election. On the North Carolina ballot, and I think it's very similar in South Carolina, in fact, there's a separate category for presidential races. In North Carolina, back in 1967, the Democrats, who dominated the General Assembly, decoupled the presidential election from the rest of the state's ballot, so that if a person wishes to vote a straight ticket for either the Republican or the Democrat, one must be careful to follow the strict instructions, and they're pretty clear instructions on the ballot, no matter which method of voting is used in that particular county, to vote in the presidential race as well as for the other partisan races on the ballot. In addition, there are two more categories of ballot questions that are not linked to a straight ticket. That's constitutional amendments and any bond issues on the ballot, as well as any nonpartisan races. And as you know, North Carolina has an increasing number of nonpartisan races in judicial races, because the General Assembly has made the elections for trial court judges and now for appellate court judges as well. They're elected on a nonpartisan ballot.
So. I'm curious, why in 1967 would the legislature, then controlled by Democrats, as you note, have done that? Is that linked because of the party? Was there some political advantage to the Democratic Party to do that back then?
Yes, more to the point, a lack of a disadvantage. You remember back in the 1960s, there were a lot of social changes in the nation. With the passage of civil rights legislation, Democrats in the South realized that they may be at some risk in future elections, and in order to avoid some sort of backlash against Democrats in the South, the thought in North Carolina was that if we separated North Carolina's general election ballot, and it's a long one, from the presidential race, that voters would still vote one way in the presidential race and another way in the rest of the statewide ballot, and they hoped that through this device that Democrats would hang on to power at the state level, while voters voted for whoever they wanted to nationally, which has been, you know, since except for 1976, when North Carolina's voters supported Jimmy Carter, the Democrat, voters here have routinely supported Republican presidential candidates,
mm-hmm.
and nobody thinks that's going to change this time either.
Right. Now, and one final thing on this: you say that it is written on the ballot that if you vote for the straight party ticket, you're not necessarily voting for president, or you have to vote separately for president. But I wonder how many people practically take a look at the instructions, the fine print when they go into the booth. They're just, a lot of them might be just looking for the names of those people they know or they've seen on campaign signs.
Apparently, voters are every bit as resistant to reading the manual first as most of us are when it comes to computers or cars or anything else that involves a little bit of technical expertise. But the instructions are fairly clear. Mm-hmm. And in addition, Gary Bartlett, who is the director of the State Board of Elections, tells me that that this year that voters will be, as they sign in to vote at their polling places, or if they vote early, as we're able to do now, will be asked if they need any assistance with voting. And they will also be reminded that for state party, straight ticket voting, they'll need to vote separately in the presidential race. I don't think that it's been the policy of the Board of Elections to do that in the past, but because this question keeps coming up, and because obviously some voters realize way too late that their votes may not have counted, and they complain so bitterly to the board, that Mr. Bartlett and his staff are prompting poll workers to add that bit about how to vote.
Well, if this thing defies logic, I mean, because on the face of it, in Truth in Advertising, you think you're voting straight ticket, you're voting for everybody. Has there ever been any effort in the legislature to change this?
I don't think there has been any serious effort to change that, at least not since I've been covering the legislature, and that goes back to 77 or so. Now, there have been legislators who wanted to change it, but with Democrats continuing to dominate in the Senate and splitting power in the House, it simply never has gotten very far to put those two back together so that one can vote for a full straight ticket on either side.
Okay. We are talking with Jack Betts from the Charlotte Observer on our Reporters Roundtable about voting in North Carolina. Let's now check in with another part of the state. John DeSantis is with us on the line. He's enterprise reporter for the Wilmington Star News. And John, I understand there's been a few big stories going on there in the Wilmington area, one of them a tussle over a development project in Carolina Beach.
There has been. And actually, not just the development project itself, but certainly as we looked at during something I worked on recently, a lot of questions about the future of that community as a whole, what it's going to look like, and some things having to do with its boardwalk area, which a lot of folks in your listening area may be familiar with.
Yeah, well, what is the future of the boardwalk area then? Because we should explain that the high-rise going in would be about 130 feet tall in some places, and right now buildings kind of top out at 50 feet. And what impact is that going to have on the boardwalk at Carolina Beach?
Well, the boardwalk itself is an area which is south of where this development would be. However, some of the persons who own businesses there have expressed concerns, number one, that this particular development could adversely affect them by way of whom it attracts and how the economy of the island works. And, again, they, too, are questioning the the city's commitment to what the boardwalk is going to be in the future by way of its commitment to new large-scale projects such as this one.
When you talk about who would the new project attract and who would it keep away, are we talking? I've seen Carolina Beach described in a number of stories about this as a blue-collar town, and now you have a restaurant there that's saying collar required coming in.
There is a culture issue, this socioeconomic issue. Carolina Beach, traditionally, according to what some residents and certainly some of these business owners have told us, is a place that's always been kind of more casual and attracted families and attracted people who were working in textile mills, people who were working in tobacco warehouses. And over the years, historically, it's kind of been that way. Mm-hmm. Now, something like this large-scale development with what could be some pricey condominiums is something that some business folks are concerned, and some residents are concerned, may change the face of Carolina Beach forever. On the flip side of that, of course, there are people who have lived on Carolina Beach for a very long time who say that the possibility for the town to realize its real estate potential, to realize its investment potential, has come.
Mm-hmm. Okay. There's another incident going on in the Wilmington area in recent weeks. You had a Homeland Security concern. There was a sailor on a Turkish merchant ship went missing, but local law enforcement was not notified, and there are questions arising there about just how good is that coordination then about if this person had been a terrorist, for instance.
That's a, and that's something that's certainly, last we knew, is still under discussion. We ran a story a couple of weeks ago with some issues that local law enforcement agencies had raised. This started when the body of a man was found on an island in the Cape Fear River, and law enforcement was trying to do what they could to figure out who he was. One detective who was at the scene thought he looked, because of certain things he saw, like he might have been a seaman, started making some inquiries and found out that a Turkish seaman had exited the vessel on the water side a week before. But local law enforcement, for the most part, says they didn't know about any such thing.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with John DeSantis. He is enterprise reporter for the Wilmington Star News, and we're talking with Jack Betts with the Charlotte Observer. Our Reporters Roundtable continues in just a moment here on The State of Things. Support for The State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners who support WUNC. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. On our Reporters Roundtable today, we have Jack Betts, political reporter and columnist for the Charlotte Observer, and John DeSantis, who's an enterprise reporter for the Wilmington Star News. Want to get back to Jack in just a moment about some amendments that will be on the state ballot, but I want to wrap up with you, John. One other story going on in the Wilmington area, the oyster harvest that you've been reporting on. It continues to have problems, the oyster industry in North Carolina, and this year's harvest has not been a good one, has it?
Not so far, although some of the state folks are telling us and some of the Sea Grant folks that could improve over time. I had the great pleasure of writing about folks in a little area of Brunswick County who took to the water on the first day of the oyster season, and women wearing straw hats and husbands and wives wearing black boots working together like they always do, and coming up with some really kind of not very big oysters, and they had some concerns about how this is going to affect them.
They're talking about how one problem has been they can't go fishing for the oysters or collecting oysters in certain parts because the state
certain areas certainly are off limits for a variety of reasons. Ironically, one of the areas where the kind of bigger oysters were was an area where Sea Grant and the state are right now experimenting with oysters to try to come up with a better and bigger oyster. But, of course, that's a seed area, and so they couldn't go there. There was some disagreement with the wildlife folks over that.
Mm-hmm. And also pollution is considered an issue, too, the runoff coming from upstream?
Yes. One of the things that has been brought up is that when you have development in an area, runoff from golf courses, runoff from homes, from lawns, is not necessarily a healthy thing for things that are living in the sea, including oysters. And how direct that connection is something that scientists are not entirely sure about yet in this case, but it's certainly something that they're looking at.
Okay. Well, Jack Betts, I want to turn back to you about what folks might be seeing on the ballots when they go to the voting booths or those who are getting their absentee ballots. When I got mine, I realized there were three constitutional amendments on the ballots. Can you briefly go over what those are about?
Sure. Perhaps the, almost assuredly the least well-known part of the ballot is the fact that North Carolina voters will decide three proposed state constitutional amendments, only one of which has generated any controversy. The proposed amendment number one brings back to voters an issue that they have twice before rejected. That's the matter of this time it's called self-financing bonds to allow public improvements for private development projects in locally designated districts. to be issued without a vote of the public, although the local government would have to vote on it, and the North Carolina Local Government Commission would also have to approve the issuing of any of these bonds to pay for those improvements.
Now, there's also an amendment on there that would get at the forfeitures that go from, say, I guess,
yeah,
drug busts, and so that would have to go to schools. It would,
yes,
be designated. And there's also the third one is about electing judges.
That's correct. By state law and tradition, the proceeds of civil penalties and forfeitures and civil fines go to a state fund for the maintenance of public schools. This amendment would make it clear that such funds are to be distributed equitably to counties on a per-pupil basis.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fairly sensible thing and clear for those who take the time to read it. And, again, magistrates' terms, which magistrates are appointed, as you know, by
and they would go, and
judges.
Actually, we have to wrap because we have to go to another interview here. But, Jack Betts, the magistrates' terms would be allowed to be going to not just the two-year term that they're
appointed. They would
appointed
be 4 years.
Jack
after,
Betts
after an initial two-year term.
Jack Betts is political reporter for the Charlotte Observer. John DeSantis is enterprise reporter for the Wilmington Star News. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you so much.
This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. Christopher Tillman was 43 years old when his first collection of short stories called In a Father's Place was published in 1990. It was an auspicious beginning, complete with a cover story in the New York Times Book Review that announced him as, quote, one of the new guys on the block. Since then, he's published a second collection of short stories and two novels. The latest is Roads of the Heart. And Christopher Tillman joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, you know, much has been made of what, I guess, in the publishing world might be considered an advanced age of a debut collection. You're 43.
Mm-hmm.
But you'd been writing rather seriously for 20 years, I understand. But it took you a long time to find your form, the short story.
Well, it did. Although I would in some ways argue that it wasn't that long, simply that it takes a while for some of us to figure it all out. But it was really more that I found a kind of material that worked for me rather than the form. The form just came along. And it was really finding place. And it was finding family. It was just the two things that now I helplessly write about. I wish I could do something else, but I can't. But it was really finding that material in the early 80s that started to lead to something resembling success.
Mm-hmm. Now, in college, you'd been writing for years, but in college you quit focusing on writing. And you joined the Navy.
Well, I was drafted, or I was told by my draft board I would be drafted unless I did something. I could take my choice, and I preferred to spend it in the water. I was one of those kids that grew up doing a lot of writing. My father was a publisher, and I grew up in a household full of books and full of writers. And when I was 15 or 16, I wrote a novel, one of those sort of things. I wish I had it, but it's long gone.
No trace of it.
No trace.
What was it about?
It was To Kill a Mockingbird. It was a boy character. My character was a boy scout, and if I recall the names right, but it was To Kill a Mockingbird in some way, some southern town, and I forget what the coalescing incidents were, but it didn't survive.
Right. Well, you describe, in a southern town, but you did not grow up in the South.
Yeah, no, I didn't. I grew up in outside Boston, and my father, as I say, was worked at Hope Mifflin in Boston. But we had had the family place on the Eastern Shore of Maryland, and I'd been going down there since I was 1 year old. And that's really what I was saying earlier about finding a place to write about. I spent the 70s after I got out of the Navy writing a variety of kind of unsuccessful novels and short stories. And it was one day when I was sitting in our place in Maryland where I often go to write and still do. I looked at that landscape and I realized that that's the landscape that had gotten so deeply into my psyche. And writing about it, it just sort of began to pour out. So, no, I'm a Yankee by birth, but certainly ever since have been writing about the Mid-Atlantic nonstop. I tried to write about New England all sorts of times, and it wasn't there. It just hadn't gone in, you know, with my with the breast milk. The way some, for some reason the Chesapeake Bay landscape did. And it, for me, it is the mere sort of visual impact of it, those bands of land and water, a certain kind of light. And it's also the many cultures that exist around the Chesapeake Bay and down to the outer banks and inner banks and just our whole tidewater area, if I can expand it to describe it in that way. And that is just such material for a fiction writer. It kind of has surprised me that it has been not mined more heavily by now than it has. But the several cultures, the farmers, the watermen, I've written short stories that are really about those two cultures alone.
You have described Maryland, which you write about so often, as, and I'm quoting here, a border state always calculating the odds, making its deals sometimes to the north with Pennsylvania, sometimes to the south with Virginia, a rather bland and boggy piece of territory whose main claim to fame was not its land or its people, but a body of water thrust into its midst.
Yes, that was one of those paragraphs you get to write if you're writing about a family member. I have rarely enjoyed writing a paragraph as much as I enjoyed writing that one. It's just the fun you get to have with what has become my home place. But there's a great deal in it that's quite serious. I've been doing quite a lot of reading of the 19th and 18th century history of Maryland because of a new book I'm working on. And it's a shabby tale. And in fact, slavery in Maryland is the most cynical of tales. I'd hardly want to say that there was anything about slavery in Mississippi that anyone could tolerate. But Maryland, it was a slave state right to 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation, which covered the Confederacy, and it remained a cynical sort of shopping in souls. This border mentality. It's not a great story.
But there's great fodder. There's great material.
There's also the other point I'd like to make about that and about Maryland, which I've knocked for not contributing great Americans to the list of our national heroes in that particular paragraph. But what's interesting to me is the two national heroes that I can think of that Maryland's contributed are Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass. I'm not sure what that really means about the border state, but I know what it means about the eastern shore of Maryland, where they both came from.
Because we often think of the North and the South in the Civil War, think of Maryland having sided with the North, but the Mason-Dixon line, of course, puts Maryland to the South.
Yeah, yeah. No, it was really, if you read the history, it's Lincoln probably spent more time calculating his moves on what would happen to Maryland than I think sort of widely understood. He delayed the Emancipation Proclamation for quite a while, in large part, at least from my reading. I could be wrong. Scholars could correct me immediately. But from my reading, because he didn't want to lose Maryland.
Now, getting back to your book, your latest novel, Roads of the Heart, you write often about fathers and children, fathers and sons, and this one is about a man in middle-aged, Eric. His marriage is in trouble. He's not close to his own son, and he takes a road trip with his 82-year-old father, who's had a stroke, is on death's door. His father, Frank, is a disgraced state senator, former state senator, and they take this road trip to Alabama so Frank can see his ex-wife. Was it necessary to move those characters out of Maryland to go on this trip to redemption?
Yes, I think it was. I think, it had something to do with just my pleasure in American landscapes. And, in fact, the trip goes on from Birmingham to Houston, and then to Denver. It takes a little circle as it gains momentum, as this 82-year-old who is erred in every conceivable way is adding to the list of things he's trying to get done before he dies. But initially, I was just interested in getting into the Deep South, and I don't know it terribly well, but have a small sympathy for it, particularly in the light of sort of northern attitudes towards the Deep South, which irritate me hugely.
And such as?
Well, the Deep South is hostile to women from Georgia to Arkansas. It would irritate beyond measure, Southerners to hear me carry on about that. But I think the attitude in many sort of my classically liberal northern friends is that it's hostile to women. Just struck me as stupid and small-minded, that this kind of many northern attitudes, as they say. So I just wanted to go there, and the way I go places is to imagine it, to write it.
Now, you live in the South now, clearly south of the Mason-Dixon line. You're in Charlottesville, Virginia.
That's
not
right.
Not just in Maryland.
Yes.
And you're a professor at UVA. Has that change of landscape coming out of the Northeast to there, has that affected your writing in any way?
It hasn't yet. But it's certainly affected my life, and it's affected my attitude. I just wanted to leave New England. I was sort of bored to death with living in New England. Would have done anything to get out of there. And the fact that it turned out that at UVA, a place where I had done visiting stints and had many friends, that I actually ended up with a permanent job there is one of the great pieces of luck in a very lucky life.
What bored you about New England?
Oh, I'd been there for too long. Some of these attitudes I was talking about sort of northern attitudes towards the South, that may have made me, may have come more just to sort of insularity, a certain pridefulness, I guess. I don't know. I was just ready to go. I like landscapes, and I like different landscapes, and I had seen everything I wanted to about that.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to ask you about your father. You mentioned a moment ago he had worked at a publishing house. He was an executive at a publishing mm-hmm. house. Did you ever feel like you had to shrug off his influence?
Someday I'm going to write a short story, or maybe just even a paragraph that doesn't have the word father in it. I don't know. No, clearly I have not been able to shrug him off. I don't really know why. It's the material. It's the mystery. At some point, you, as a writer, you just don't question where you get your stories from. You just got to do it. And so we all end up repeating ourselves by the time we're 50 and 60, as I am in between.
Now, was there a danger in that, in repeating yourself?
Only a danger if you're not, your attitudes aren't changing, if you don't have new things to say. The father in this novel, Roads of the Heart, what he does, what his tasks are, and how the son regards him is not something I could have written 10 years ago. I would have had no clue about those attitudes what impels them. So I think if I were writing the same thing over and over again, it would be awful, and it would be found out instantly by any reader that may exist. But in this case, I just think they're very different takes on the same material.
Do you have more sympathy for your father now?
I had a great deal of sympathy for my father really, really all along. This was me trying to capture the last few years of my father's life. He died before I started writing this. But the novel starts on a conundrum about a word. It's a riddle. He's saying a sound, and the son can't figure out what it is. And so the conversation was, well, here's what I used to do with my mother, who was like that,
He's saying the word, what the son translates is the word mistake.
That's right. He's saying the word, the sound is matsex, and the son finally figures out in the end it's mistakes. And what the father is saying is looking back on his own life and saying that he made mistakes. And for this particular father, that's an enormous admission. And it's what sets the novel going. Okay, he has said he made mistakes. Now, what's he going to do about it? And as it turns out, the father has a very specific plan in mind, which involves getting in a car.
And hitting the road.
And hitting the road.
When you got to college, you quit writing to focus on music.
Yes. Music has been a part of my life also from the beginning, and it's something I'm passionate about now. I've been on a kick, on a Baroque opera kick for about 5 years, which just gets rather stylized, but
now,
I love it.
Performing this or just,
an
appreciator of this?
No, an appreciator. I occasionally do with my students a little shtick they don't particularly love, but there's something behind it. So I say, now, wait a minute, I say to them in the workshops, if you all could sing, if we all could sing, we wouldn't be doing this writing stuff, right? And they look at me anxiously and angrily and say, well, what are you talking about? But yes, expressing myself through music, I can't imagine a life without it. And that's in college. That's what I was studying more than anything. Theory and composition. Spent a year harmonizing Bach chorales, which still remains my one great exercise in form. Poets have forms they work in. Fiction writers don't. But working in form is something that's a wonderful exercise, and I did it for a year. So all the lessons of music I try and translate.
Well, Christopher Tillman, thanks for talking with us today.
Well, thank you. It's been lots of fun.
Christopher Tillman is author of 4 books. The most recent is the novel Roads of the Heart. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava, and on Thursdays, we take a look across the state at things to do over the weekend. We'll be talking with one of the stars of a new musical headed for Broadway. It's having its tryout at Duke University. But first, to Yadkin County, just 20 minutes west of Winston-Salem, you can find the nation's fastest growing wine region. And on Saturday, the Yadkin Valley Grape Festival will give you an opportunity to sample that local product. Michael Helton of Hanover Park Vineyard in Yadkinville joins us on the phone. Welcome, Michael Helton.
Well, thank you. How are you today, Melinda?
I'm fine. Now, this is a relatively new industry in Yadkin County, wine, the wineries growing grapes, but you're considered an old-timer there at this business.
Well, prior to 99, there was only 2 of the 10 wineries that were in existence making European-style or regular vinifera wine. Mm-hmm. So we started up in 99, and then there's been, about 25 after this. Wow. So in one respect, I am one of the old-timers.
Now, how did you come to get into the wine business?
My wife and I took a honeymoon to the south of France. Wine was $2 or $3 a bottle, and water, a small bottle of water, was $7, $8, $9 a bottle. So we became used to drinking wine with our meals. And after a month over there, I really had an enormous opinion of wine, because I didn't have one before we went over there.
You'd never had wine before?
Well, I'd had wine, yes, but just, mm-hmm. 3 or 4 glasses, 5 glasses a year at best.
Oh, okay.
Probably didn't enjoy 3 of them. I knew nothing about wine, but in the south of France, drinking wine with every meal for a month, I developed a very strong feeling about wine, and so when we returned, needed a project, and so I picked, we picked some land and started putting in grapes and planting.
Now, how many acres do you grow?
We have at the moment 5.5 acres, mm-hmm. And I buy from some nearby vineyards about another 8 acres.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand that growing of wine, of grapes and making wine has been pitched as a way for tobacco farmers to develop a new crop. Are there a lot of tobacco farmers in Yadkin County who have switched over to grapes?
I wouldn't say necessarily there's a lot of them. There's a significant importance in that some of the larger ones have, and there are, I know of 4 in the county that are major tobacco growers that have supplemented their income with growing grapes. And actually one of them went so far as to build a winery as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have a winery yourself, or are you growing grapes only?
We do both.
You do both.
I have a vineyard, and we have our own winery and a tasting room. It's in an old farmhouse built in 1897.
Yeah. So how does North Carolina wine, how does Yadkin Valley wine, Yadkin County wine, compare?
In international and national competitions, we are taking awards, gold medals and silver medals and bronzes. So we've been well received. biggest hurdle is for people to actually discover that North Carolina wine is no longer the sweet wine and is no longer just muscadine wine.
Right.
That there are some really fine wines being made here that will stand up to anything in California or out of, well, perhaps even out of France in some cases. But some very, very nice wines are being made here.
Yeah, and now labels matter very much. And I understand that Yadkin Valley is now classified as an American viticultural area. And this is an important label to get. It has to do with what the geography, the climate, and in other words, the grape. It means the grapes grown there are those that you could identify from being grown there because of those conditions?
It should have some similarity because the AVA, by its definition, has to have a similarity, and it's usually a geography or rain or weather, temperature, that makes, hopefully, the grapes grown in that area have a consistent flavor or a consistent attitude. And the wines, we're very fortunate and pleased to have the AVA, the designation. It took a couple years, but now we have the only one in the state of North Carolina. The Yadkin Valley AVA, as it's referred to. We now actually have wine country. People can come up to visit the wine country and go to tours of the different vineyards and wineries. And it's just really a nice time to enjoy.
Yeah. Well, Yadkin Valley AVA has a certain ring to it, I think. But, now, what's your specialty, Michael Helton? What does your Hanover Park Vineyard make in terms
of? Well, we have the Chardonnay and a Cabernet Sauvignon, but in addition to that, those are the normal ones I think that most places will be making. But we also have a Cabernet Franc, and we do a Mourvèdre, which is a Rhone style of the south of France. And the Mourvèdre has been very, very popular. It's not a well-known grape, but in addition to that, one that has taken off and become very popular is Viognier. It's a white, nice, crisp, summer-type wine, and most of the wineries up here are making it. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that makes it unique is that it doesn't grow well in most of the world, except in the south of France and in the Yadkin Valley. It grows very well here, and it makes a wonderful alternative to Chardonnay.
And the important question when we're talking, another important question when you're talking about wine, is how much would some of these go per bottle? Are these very much boutique wines that would command a high price, or are these ones, you know, you'd find for under $10 a bottle?
Well, not at the upper level boutique, but they're usually running between $8 and maybe $16. Mm-hmm. And the average probably $12 to $14.
Okay. Well, Michael Helton, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Well, it's our pleasure, but tomorrow I'd like to invite your listening audience to come up to the Yadkin Valley for the Yadkin Valley Wine Grape Festival that's going to be held in Yadkinville. It's from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m.
Okay. And that's happening on Saturday. Is that Saturday,
yes.
Correct?
Okay. This is Saturday, October 23rd.
Okay, great. Well, Michael
downtown
Helton, thanks.
Yadkinville.
Michael Helton, thanks for being with us.
Appreciate you.
Michael Helton is with Hanover Park Vineyard in Yadkinville.
Thank you, Melissa.
Now, in the Triangle this weekend, there's a chance to see some potential theater history in the making. Theater Previews at Duke, which is part of Duke's Department of Theater Studies, has teamed up with a group of New York producers to try out a new musical adaptation of Louisa May Alcott's much-beloved novel, Little Women. This musical production runs at Duke through the end of October. It's slated to head to Broadway in December. It stars veteran singer-actress Maureen McGovern and Tony Award-winning Broadway star Sutton Foster. Sutton Foster joins us by phone. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
And also with us is Alan Nee. He wrote the book, the libretto, for the new musical, Little Women. Welcome, Alan Nee.
Thanks. Hi.
Hi. Well, Sutton Foster, I would like to start with you. You are playing Joe.
Yes, ma'am.
Were you a fan of the book Little Women when you were a girl?
You know, I had never read it growing up. I've thus read it now. But I'd never read it growing up. I had watched the movie. The first time I was really ever introduced to the story was the Winona Ryder movie in, I guess, 1994. And then this past summer, I've read the novel.
Now, a sizable chunk of the female population in the U.S. has read the novel and wanted to be Jo March when they were growing up. I wonder if that presents a challenge to you as you're depicting.
Absolutely, it does. Because all these, you know, people have these ideas about, well, first of all, this novel is so beloved, and people, you know, that have read it, they are very passionate about this story and about these characters, and they've envisioned, you know, Joe and Amy and Meg and Beth in their minds, and it's been really interesting because I trust so much in the creative staff, you know, the writers and the director, and I'm bringing who I am to the role, and I just hope that I can honor what Louisa May Alcott wrote, and I can't try to fulfill everyone's imagination and everyone's, you know, preconception about this character, but I hope that I can, you know, infuse enough of myself and honor what she wrote and try to embody this character as much as I can.
Which part of yourself do you think you infuse that with the most? I mean, what characteristic of yours turns up?
Well, I grew up, when I was growing up as a teenager, and still even now, I was never a girly girl. And Joe is not even close to being a girly girl, and quite a bit of a tomboy. You know, my interests were in, I was an actress, but my interests were in, you know, making my own name for myself, for taking care of myself, for, you know, doing things, being a strong woman. You know, Joe March is, she wants to take care of her family and do things no woman has ever done before and conquer the world. And she's an incredible role model to me now as an adult. But I think that as a young girl, I never wanted to fall into any type of mediocrity. I wanted to be exceptional. And I think that's what Jo March is. Her main drive and goal is.
Mm-hmm. Well, we are talking with Sutton Foster, the Tony Award winning actress from Broadway, who is in the role of Jo in Little Women, which is a musical that's in preview at Duke before it goes to Broadway. Alan Nee, you adapted the book to become a musical. You did the book for this musical. What? And you knew you wanted Sutton Foster for the lead role here. Is that right?
I didn't know how much I wanted her until I actually met her. And then I really wanted her a lot. Sutton Foster, to me, is Jo March. I mean, it's like you want that meshing of souls. I mean, even as a writer, you want to mesh your soul with with whoever the characters you're writing. And then you hope that you'll find that meshing of soul in the casting. And it's not easy. I mean, I can't tell you how grateful I am to have Sutton Foster playing Jo March. I mean, it's an incredible performance to me. It's unique. It's unique in every way. It's a writer's dream to find that kind of actress to match the soul of the work. You know, you hope for the best, but you can't anticipate that.
Right. Well, it got a very nice review. Your performance there, Foster, got a very nice review in the News and Observer. Orla Swift wrote, "It takes mere moments to fall in love with her, Jo." And speaking of gawkiness, candor, and charisma, all in the same sentence there. Alan Nee, what drew you to Little Women as a story you wanted to tell?
The rite of passage always interests me. And I have a film coming out called Finding Neverland, which is about rite of passage of growing up. And my life has been sort of devoted as a grown-up to writing about the rite of passage of from childhood to adulthood. I've been interested in the working woman of the 19th century and the liberation of the soul, really, very early on. And I just was gravitated towards it. I wrote it even without music when I first wrote it. And then it worked so well on so many levels that, you know, I've ultimately had composer, lyricist, come collaborate with me. So it's been a journey for me also. But I love this character, and I love this story of this unique family. It's in many ways, though I feel very much an identification with Jo March, I didn't have the loving family that the Marches represent in Little Women. And it's sort of wonderful to write about that. You know, it's like, in some ways, it's like a wish fulfillment to write about these people. I had a lot of brothers, not a lot of sisters.
Well, there was Little Men.
There was Little Men, but that's not about brothers, really.
Right. Now, a tryout for a Broadway musical usually takes place somewhat closer to New York City. I'm wondering why do this in North Carolina, and how much additional work, what changes you might make between this production and what may be debuting on Broadway in December?
The amazing thing is how much change took place down here. I mean, we have five new songs in the show since we've been down here. Being this far from New York has been a tremendous opportunity. It's given us a lot of freedom that if you're close to New York, you wouldn't have. We should be under the scrutiny of New York, you know, gossip, New York critics. And here you had a lot of freedom. I mean, this has been such a treat for me to be this isolated from New York. I mean, I thought I wasn't going to like it. I have loved it. So we've done a lot of work here. I hope most of the work is done. There's still some work to do, but a lot of it has been done, and all good. And I'm not just saying that because I want people to go see it. I really feel deeply all the work has been really good down here. Also, our lead producer, our line producer, was a student at Duke University in the theater department. So there's been that sort of attachment to Duke. Mm-hmm. And we tried this play out 3 years ago in a much more primitive form in a black box at Duke. So this is really, Duke has really been responsible for the history of Little Women as a musical.
Well, Sutton Foster, you started out as an understudy for Thoroughly Modern Millie, and your performance in that musical ended up winning you a Tony 2 years ago, made you a bona fide Broadway star. What made, and I imagine you must have gotten a lot of offers after that success, what made Little Women stand out as the next project you wanted to work on?
I had been sent the script to read, and I remember sitting in my dressing room at Millie, with the script and the CD to listen to some songs. And I read through the script. It was in between shows on a Saturday. And I was listening to the music, and it was the best script I had received. I was laughing. I was crying. And I called my agent and said, I really like it a lot. And it was the first thing I had received that I just fell in love with. And the role was something that I just couldn't turn down. I knew that I was not going to be able to play a teenager for the rest of my life. And I thought, I'll regret it for the rest of my life if I don't play this part.
Great. Well, I wish you a lot of luck with that and hope you have a nice long run after Duke and up on Broadway.
Thank you.
Thank you, too, for being with us, Alan Nee.
My pleasure.
Okay. Our thanks to Sutton Foster, who plays Joe in the production of Little Women, a musical that's playing through October 31st at the Reynolds Theater in the Bryan Center on Duke's West Campus. And thanks also to librettist Alan Nee. He wrote the book for the musical. It opens on Broadway in December. And for today, that's the state of things. Our show is directed by Keith Weston, edited by Dave DeWitt, produced by Jordana Gustafson, Stephanie Hirsch, and Jennifer Deere. Susan Davis is the senior producer. Fred Wasser is our executive producer. Support for The State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm Melinda Pencava, and let's go out now listening to a little bit of Sutton Foster, a song from her production of Thoroughly Modern Millie, for which she won a Tony in 2002.